Americans purchase nearly 600 million pounds of candy each year for Halloween. Several pounds are likely to end up in your home staring at you in the weeks to come. You probably right now have a giant bowl in your house like I do. I've got three giant bowls of candy in my house. Our guest is Dr. Kami Haas. He's the author of the number one national bestseller, If Your Mouth Could Talk, an in-depth guide to oral health and its impact on your entire life. Dr. Haas, welcome to WICC.
Well, thank you very much.
So let me ask you this. One piece of candy is not going to kill me, is it?
Well, yes, I'm a dentist, but I'm a dad as well. I have a 10-year-old. So, yes, one piece is not going to kill you. Of course, we want to make sure, you know, our kids have fun and we have fun at Halloween. We just want to make sure that we do it in a way that we don't end up in the dentist chair after a few weeks, right?
Yeah. So what is what's the number one mistake people make when they're eating sweets, especially again with all the candy everybody's got in their home right now? Where are we going wrong, Dr. Haas?
That's a great question. So a few things. One is, I think people go trick or treating or start start eating their candy when on an empty stomach. We all know what happens when we go to the supermarket on an empty stomach or around the country. We just shove our faces with every candy we can get. So my first recommendation is make sure that the kids eat, obviously trick-or-treating hopefully is over, but just, after dinner or something so they're not super hungry. If you're going to eat candy, do it in all setting. Another big mistake I see is parents ask the kids or themselves after they eat, they go brush their teeth right away. But in fact, you should never, ever brush your teeth for at least 30 to 60 minutes after any meal or drink, especially all that candy, because what it does, it reduces the pH of the mouth from neutral, which is about 7, to below 5.5, which is extremely acidic. And that's when you don't want to get the toothbrush and rub all of that acid all over your teeth. So if you're going to brush your teeth, you should brush before eating anything, like with a toothpaste that has, some ingredients like nanohydroxyapatite that literally buffers the teeth and protects it against acid.
Dr. Haas, I'm 47 years old, and you're the first person that's ever said that. And now I feel like I've been doing it wrong my entire life. So let me ask you this.
You're not the only one.
Oh, I'm sure.
This is probably one of the biggest mistakes I see. I even see dentists recommend brushing right after a meal. But we've known for a couple decades that that's the worst time to do it. By the way, if you do want something some oral care product to use after your meals to reverse the pH and make your mouth healthier, you should use a mouth rinse or a mouth spray. As long as the kids are over age 6, because they don't swallow the mouthwash is perfect, especially if it's an alkaline mouthwash. Again, most over-the-counter mouthwashes are terrible because they're very acidic, and that's an easy thing to check. You can get a pH strip, which is, for pennies. And you can just check your mouthwash, and it should be alkaline over the pH of 7. Under age 6, mouth spray would be just fine for kids, as long as it's safe again.
So there are some mouthwashes that are actually harmful to your teeth then?
The majority, unfortunately.
Wow.
So mouthwashes, this is a question I get asked all the time. Hey, Dr. Haas, is mouthwash good for your mouth or bad for your mouth? Because there's just, and again, it's like everything else. It's like food. There's good food and bad food. Candy, unfortunately, is just bad candy and worse candy. But with mouthwash, there is actually good mouthwash and bad mouthwash. Bad mouthwashes are the ones that are the artificial colors you see, neon and fluorescent and glow in the dark. Obviously, those are artificial things that don't appear in nature, artificial preservatives, and especially acidic pH. So, again, I really recommend that people, they should, and it's very easy. You can just get a pH strip and check your mouthwash. There are many good mouthwashes, high pHs, alkaline pHs. They have prebiotics that provide the nutrients for the good microbes, and they remove the bad microbes, selectively. That's another area I see. Most oral care products, unfortunately, have antibiotics that kill your oral microbiome indiscriminately, but we can't survive without our microbes in our mouth and our gut, so we want to keep them healthy and just remove the bad ones.
Wow, Dr. Kami Haas, you're killing me here. Best-selling author of If Your Mouth Could Talk, go-to expert on dental health. This guy's been on ABC, CBS, The Doctors, Fox, Inside Edition, and more. Wow, you're really turning up my whole idea of dental care on my head. So right yesterday, my kids came home, and right away they went over to the bucket. They both grabbed a couple pieces, and I was like, guys, let's limit it. How many pieces of candy would you have to eat before you develop a cavity?
That's another great question. It's really, there's so many factors. I know people think of it as a simple, hey, it's sugar and not brushing your teeth. But there are many other factors, the pH, what's in the diet as opposed to just, you know, just the sugar. Like we need, you know, calcium and vitamin D and K2. If the saliva is in a good condition, what kind of oral care product. So there's a lot of factors for cavities. Having said that, if you're going to eat candy, the worst candies, you know, the bad candies are all the candies, but the worst candies are the ones that stick to your teeth because they linger longer as a food source for the bad microbes that then they eat the sugar and they excrete acid and they cause a hole in the teeth that we call cavities. Or candies that can break, you know, jawbreakers and really, really hard candies that they can chip the teeth, they can break orthodontic devices or break the filling. So those are the kind of candies you want to avoid. As far as how many, you should, you know, a few, you know, as long as you don't get a stomach ache, it's fine. As long as they're done in one setting. Another mistake I see is they drag the candy, you know, one candy every hour or like, you know, throughout the day. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to do candy, if you're going to eat anything sweet, just do it in one setting. Then do your mouthwash or mouth spray, and then you can brush your teeth after about an hour, and then you should be in a good condition.
So, Dr. Haas, probably
everything
like
about balance, right?
So here's my thought now, right? My kids will come home today. They usually come home and they're hungry as soon as they get home from school. I think they just do lunch a little too early or whatever. I should feed them lunch first and then maybe afterwards bring the bowl over. You could each grab a piece of candy. Now that they're less full, they'll eat less candy. Ha ha. Dr. Haas, you're also helping with the parenting here. I appreciate that too.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I'm a dad myself. So, yeah, I'm trying to always be reasonable with, you know, provide practical solutions, right?
I was just going to say, you know, that's the whole part of it is a lot of times, you know, you'll get a doctor that'll be like, no sweets. And it's like, I'm not doing that. Seriously.
Well, I think we all want to live in the reality of what's happening.
Yeah.
So
yeah, certainly. Moderation is super important. But again, it didn't even occur to me. But sure, if a kid's already eaten and you're treating a piece of candy like it's dessert, they probably won't even want another piece. If they do, fine. They're probably not going to want much more than that, or the little belly will be all filled up. Brilliant.
Exactly.
I just got a text from my mom, who has a million questions about everything that's going on. She heard you talking about the mouthwash. She asked, is there a particular brand or a particular kind that you would recommend over the others?
There are many good mouthwashes. Your mom or your listeners can Google, you know, alkaline mouthwash. And so a few things to avoid, you know, I call it mouthrageous ingredients, the things you want to avoid, and mouth-standing ingredients, the ones you want to have. Mouthrageous ones are anything artificial, obviously. You know, artificial colors are the obvious ones, all the neon fluorescent colors that you see lined up in your oral care aisle at the supermarket. You definitely want to avoid those. Anything that has antibiotics, those mouthwashes that say it kills 99.99% of germs, are terrible. Imagine this. If I just told you, hey, to just prevent disease, take two antibiotics every single day indefinitely, and you're not going to catch a disease, you're going to say, this doctor is crazy, you know, I'm going to hang up on him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we know antibiotics for temporarily is fine for, like, if you have an acute infection, but not to take it in prolonged period. Well, we don't want to do the same thing with our mouth. Our mouth is filled with billions of microbes, somewhere between 5 to 100. Most of them are crucial to our survival. They help us with our digestion, keeping our mouth healthy. They break down the food into nitric oxide, which is a molecule that's critical for our survival. There was a study done a couple of months ago that showed that people that use those types of mouthwashes that kill all the microbes have a high risk of heart attacks. And you know, and that's because those nitric oxide molecules help dilate the blood vessels. So again, avoid antibiotics, avoid artificial colors, and avoid acidic pH. What you want in a mouthwash is alkaline mouthwash, prebiotics, which helps the good microbes and removes the bad ones, and things like xylitol, erythritol, and then maybe some hydroxyapatite. Hydroxyapatite is an ingredient in mouthwash and toothpaste. Which is really what your teeth are naturally made out of. 97% of enamel is made out of that calcium phosphate mineral. So that's one of my favorite ingredients in mouthwash or toothpaste.
And let me ask you this, Dr. Haas, and this might be a stupid question. If it is, forgive me. I'm not a doctor. Does sugar impact kids' dental health more than adults or no?
Yes.
It
and
does.
The reason is because they're, that's a really good question.
Thank you.
As adults, our teeth are, you know, it's rare for adults to get new cavities, because if you were going to get a cavities, those nooks and crannies were you already gotten as a child. So we get a ton more cavities in children's teeth. The other reason is their teeth and their bodies and their mouths are still developing and growing. So they're more prone to, you know, toxic materials in their bodies and in their mouths. They need nutrients for their mouth to grow properly. So, like, as adults, our mouths are grown, right? We just need to prevent cavities and gum disease. On kids, they not only they need the right ingredients to protect their teeth and gums from bacteria, but they actually need nutrients for those teeth to still grow, for that mouth to still grow. And so, like, just a few ingredients quickly for those parents that are listening. Obviously, we know calcium is critical for our healthy teeth and bones. But what most people don't know is calcium by itself doesn't work. It requires three vitamins to get into your teeth and your bones: vitamin A, vitamin D, and vitamin K2. Vitamin A is prevalent in our food, in our Western society, so most of us have adequate amount of it. But almost 90% of the population in U.S. and Western Europe, we are deficient in vitamin K2, which puts the calcium into the blood, into the teeth, and vitamin D, which carries the calcium from our intestines to our teeth and our bones. So I always recommend that parents and children, everybody, get either supplements or make sure that their oral care products have these two vital nutrients in them, vitamin D and vitamin K2, along with calcium.
My guest this hour, Dr. Kami Haas, the best-selling author of If Your Mouth Could Talk. He's the go-to dental health expert on The Doctors, ABC News, CBS News, Fox TV, Inside Edition, and more. And we're very lucky and very thankful to have you with us today, Dr. Haas. This has been...
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, this has been... again, I like to think I know what I'm talking about for the most part. I like to think I'm giving my kids the right lessons, but I'm apparently not. And so help me out a little bit more. Let's talk about the exact steps one should take to have perfect oral care.
Okay, wonderful. So first, you got to start with the right oral care products, right? Not all toothbrushes are made the same. Not all toothpaste are made the same, or mouthwashes or flosses and tongue scrapers and everything else. So I have, again, in my book, a full list of how to pick the right products, you know, if you're high risk versus low risk. But let's just say you've gotten the right products for the right person. In the morning, your routine should be before breakfast. This is really important, as we discussed earlier. Mm-hmm. You do not want to brush your teeth after a meal. So right before, when you wake up, before breakfast, you want to do this routine. You want to start with an alkaline mouthwash to reverse the pH and loosen the plaque and the food particles that's been built up overnight. You first start with a mouthwash or mouth rinse. Next, you want to floss your teeth because you can't really get between the teeth with any tools other than floss. Again, your floss needs to be safe and effective, no petroleum in it, no Teflon on it. I always recommend that either your floss should be infused with the right oral care ingredients, like xylitol or erythritol, or just like you wouldn't brush without a toothpaste, mm-hmm. Why would you want to floss without anything on it, right?
Right.
Or at least dip your floss in the right toothpaste before you, you know, put it between your teeth. So mouthwash, then floss. Then you want to use a tongue scraper to clean your tongue, because the tongue is an unbelievable source of bacteria for bad breath, and it interferes with taste. And toothbrush is really not made to remove the bacteria on the tongue crevices. So a tongue cleanser, a tongue brush, or a tongue scraper, I recommend to do it. And then right after that, then you brush with a toothpaste. Again, the brush has to have soft bristles or ultra soft bristles, because 74% of our population in the U.S. have dental sensitivity. And the number one reason behind that is people brush too harsh, or they use coarse toothbrushes like charcoal brushes, which are terrible. They can damage the enamel. They can damage the gum tissues. They can make the teeth sensitive. So that's the routine in the morning, before breakfast. In the evening, you reverse it, pretty much. What you do floss first. You know, you can at least floss once a day. You know, we don't have to do it twice. But mm-hmm. If you're going to do it, then floss, tongue scraper, brush with toothpaste. And then the last thing you do is use that mouthwash for the overnight protection.
Oh, very good.
Before bedtime. So before breakfast, BB. Before bedtime, BB.
All right, that's solid. Should we brush more often if we're eating more things with sugar in it, and or are there other ways to combat cavities?
Another great question. I recommend brushing just twice a day, in the morning and the evening. You can brush, you know, midday too, but it's not necessary. One of my favorite secret weapons for anti-cavity and to keep the mouth healthy throughout the day, because there's typically a 16-hour, you know, space between the morning routine and the evening routine. Well, what do you do? That's your question. What do you do throughout the day? Well, my secret weapon is a mouth spray. So a mouth spray is kind of a light mouthwash. You can think of it that way. Mm-hmm. What I love about it is because you can fit it in your pocket. You can give it to your kid, put it in a lunchbox, in a backpack, you can put it in your purse. So in other words, you can take it everywhere, and you can use it anywhere because you don't need to spit it out. You need a sink. You just take it out and spray your mouth. Again, the same things, advice that I give about the mouthwash applies here. So you don't want those terrible. The typical mouth spray is terrible, the ones that people use it to mask their bad breath because of their poor oral health. You want to make sure that the mouth spray actually has the right ingredients. Again, prebiotics, xylitol, erythritol, it's pH balanced or it's alkalizing, because that's the whole goal of it. You want to, after each meal or drink, just but quickly to tell you how you get cavities is at your mouth is at neutral, about pH is 7 approximately. Just about every time you put food in your mouth or any drink, the pH becomes acidic, goes down. Once it reaches 5.5, that's when some of the minerals in your teeth called hydroxyapatite, they start dissolving away from your teeth. And within an hour, the saliva gets reversed and those minerals get deposited back. But if you eat too much sugar or if you eat too frequently throughout the day, the body doesn't have enough time to put those minerals back in the teeth. And that's how you get a hole in the tooth that we call a cavity. So what this mouth spray can do is can reverse the pH much, much quicker and then keep your teeth healthy and your mouth happy throughout the day.
Oh, that is brilliant. Dr. Kami Haas, best-selling author of If Your Mouth Could Talk. Again, the website is Dr. Kami Haas. It's KamiHoss.com. We're also going to put this up on the WICC 600 podcast. So for anybody, if you're hearing this and you're like, he's telling me more stuff than I can write down right now, you will be able to listen to the podcast version of this a little bit later on today. You mentioned, Dr. Haas, soft bristle toothbrushes. My other question as far as a toothbrush is concerned, and my wife gives me flack for this all the time, is how often should we change out our toothbrush?
Toothbrush. Once every 1 to 3 months. And so the difference is if you've been sick, you should change it after your sickness. If the bristles are super soft, which are actually the better ones, they start losing their effectiveness quicker. Like, there are two types of bristles that I love. One is just soft nylon. The other one is PBT. That's short for a very long name. PBT bristles are extremely soft, but they're extremely effective. The only thing is they lose their effectiveness quicker than nylon. So you use it, and then you kind of want to change it every 1 to 2 months. Nylon, that usually lasts about 3 months, so no later than 3 months. The other tip for the toothbrush is you want to keep it away from other people's toothbrush. So if you share the sink with your spouse or children, you don't want to put it in the same cup as other bristles because bacteria can be transferred. The bristles is just a big source of bacteria growing on it. You want to keep it in a dry area. Keep it away from near. Don't keep it near toilets because mm-hmm. Particles can get on it. And then of course change it after a sickness. So those are some tips to keep your toothbrush in a good shape between getting new bristles.
My mother just texted me.
By the way,
me.
Manual and electric are both fine too. That's another question.
I was going to ask you about that too. My wife uses an electric toothbrush. And she's like, I don't know why you don't get one of these. Are they better?
They're not better. As long as you're using them correctly, the manual and electric are both fine. So use whatever you like. So if you like manual, you use manual. If your wife prefers the electric, yeah. As long as they're both high-quality bristles and high-quality brush, they're both perfectly fine to use.
Oh, excellent. Dr. Kami Haas, best-selling author of If Your Mouth Could Talk, please go visit his website. DrKamiHoss.com. It's KamiHoss.com. Dr. Haas, I certainly appreciate your time. Amazing information. My mom was just texting me. She's like, this guy's brilliant. I think especially this time of the year, I think it's a good time for people to sort of revisit their dental habits. You know, we've got a lot of candy we're eating now in the aftermath of Halloween. My son pointed out that by the time we finish the Halloween candy, it'll be Christmas time, and he knows that means even more candy. So we've at least got a plan, Dr. Haas. We've got a plan going forward. He is 7 years old. He's seven, and he's a real smart you-know-what.
I know what. I have a 10-year-old, so I'm with you.
Yeah.
By the way, if you like this information, obviously 100 times more of that about oral health and all sorts of connection, it is in my book, and you can get the book on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever your favorite book is sold.
Yeah, a number one national bestseller, by the way. Definitely a book everybody should check out. Dr. Kami Haas, really appreciate the time. Again, drkamihaas.com, K-A-M-I-H-O-S-S. Dr. Haas, really appreciate all this great info. Have a great day. Much appreciated.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. You too.
All right. For about the last week or so, I have been blowing up Terry Cowgill's cell phone. Well, his daughter was trying to get married in Seattle. I was just constantly texting this guy when he got on the plane, right? When he got off the plane, I was like, Terry, I need you. Terry Cowgill, how are you, my man?
Hey, hey, not bad. I'm adjusting to life back in the Northeast.
I think I literally, like, you got off the plane, you turned your phone on, and there was another text from me. You must have felt like the paparazzi was all up on you.
I did, yeah, but I was really looking forward to that interview, and it was very interesting. And you know, I love the way you started it off, because everybody probably remembers, you know, Stephen Colbert, before he started hosting late night on CBS, he had a show called The Colbert Report on Comedy Central, and he played this sort of knockoff character of Bill O'Reilly, and he'd sit there and he'd interview these people, and he'd get some progressives and liberals on the show. And the first thing he said to them was, "Why do you hate America?"
Yeah.
And it always got a good laugh from just about everybody. And it was a parody of itself. And I think that maybe that's what you were trying to accomplish there with your first question to Johanna Hayes.
You know, Terry, funny story. The day before the interview, I have a 19-year-old daughter who considers herself, you know, a liberal and a feminist. And I mentioned I was going to be talking to Johanna Hayes, and we had a brief conversation about just the election in general. And I asked her, I said, "What do you know about Johanna Hayes?" You know what the first thing she said to me was? "She's a member of the squad." And I said, no, she's not. I don't, you know. And again, that was kind of my next question to her was, it's because you're a black woman. People just want to lump you in with those other women of color. I looked up the voting records, right? They don't vote lockstep. Seven major issues that they don't vote lockstep in. I mean, I think Johanna Hayes is very much her own person in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and I think she's, she did have her picture taken with some members of the squad sort of early in her tenure. I think she's been careful not to align herself too closely with members of the squad. For one thing, their politics are farther left than hers.
Mm-hmm.
And for another thing, most of these members of the squad, like AOC and Ilhan Omar and Ayanna Pressley up in Massachusetts, they're in very safe districts.
Right.
You know, and she's not. She's mm-hmm. in a I would say the 5th congressional district leans Democratic, and it has been for ever since Nancy Johnson got defeated by Chris Murphy in 2006. But it's never a wipeout. It's generally competitive, as it is this time, and of course the latest polls show it neck and neck. So I like the fact that she did that, and she's not an AOC clone. And she did bring up the possibility that maybe she's being lumped in with the squad because she happens to be a woman of color.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that's true or not, but it's certainly worth raising that question.
Yeah. You know, again, I know a lot of people hate when you make, everything's about race. Everything's about race. I do think that there's got to be some element of that. You know, again, as I started, I knew I was going to get her on for an interview, and I really wanted to, you know, again, I like to know my stuff. I deep dived her record. I expected her to be much similar in her voting record than AOC and the other members of the squad, and that just isn't the reality of it. And I thought, right? I think it's unfortunate. You know, the other thing I brought up was I hate, like, I had I've had lots of Republicans on this show. Bob Stefanowski popped on the other day, slightly unannounced. I hate when people talk about us having an open border. That is so untrue. Is our border a disaster? Sure. Is it porous? Yes. Is the policy in America that it's open? No. And I think when politicians, especially Republicans, say that, I feel like it takes a lot of the wind out of the sails of the rest of the argument, because you're saying something that is obviously not true, as evidenced by 2 million arrests at the border. And so, I mean, it's one thing to say there's a crisis at the border. It's another thing to suggest it's open, because open sounds like, you know, these fentanyl-carrying cartel members are crossing with impunity, and that's just not how it is.
Yeah, and as Hayes pointed out also, that most of the fentanyl that's being smuggled over the border is being smuggled by American citizens. And then when I was in Seattle, in fact, and my son and I were talking about this, I was reminded when I saw the port of Seattle and all of these giant cranes and shipping containers being loaded on and off the loading dock, that's actually where most of the fentanyl is being smuggled, is in those shipping containers, which are very difficult to police compared to actually physically crossing the border. So, yes, I'm glad that you straightened that out, because it really is a misinformation of the worst sort. But open borders, you know, it's only three syllables, and it has impact that way outweighs three syllables. It punches way above its weight in impact.
Now, Terry, normally when I said that, I also point out, I'm like, listen, you know, when Kamala Harris said the border was secured, no. Like, I would also condemn that. It's definitely not secure. There's definitely issues there. But, again, I just, you know, the same thing with, and again, had Bob Stefanowski pop on, and I said, Bob, listen, crime is down. It's down. The numbers are all going downward, have been for a decade. So let's not say crime is rampant and it's up. What you should be saying, and what is more realistic, is crime's in the suburbs. And just about everybody has either been a victim, or there's been something in their neighborhood, or a close friend. Myself, I had a buddy who had his car stolen, and I've had three friends who had their cars broken into since July. So I feel it. There was a shooting in Weathersfield about five streets away from my house recently. I feel the effects of it. I don't feel unsafe, but the violent crime stuff is up, and that is scary. So, again, if you're trying to be honest and you want to have a serious conversation, to like throw the crime stats out the window, I think, again, yeah, sort of plays into the fear of people like, I don't care what that says. We all don't do that. You can say, listen, we're all seeing it, the catalytic converters, the car break-ins, the carjackings, they're doing it in broad daylight at this point. I feel like if politicians, again, when you say, you could make some great points. The second you throw one of those nonsensical rhetoric lines in there about open borders or rampant crime, it diminishes the entire argument, and your argument would have been solid without that.
Yeah, I mean, Bob could have said something like, I understand that crime is down, but it's still way too high.
Yep.
And we need to work on that, blah, blah, blah. Because that state police report that came out, and I believe, as you said, it covered like the last 10 years, murder and rape are up slightly, but everything else is down. As I also pointed out in Twitter, the Republicans, they like to complain about media coverage of these elections, as saying they haven't been treated fairly, and the media haven't gone after Lamont and all the Democrats. But they Republicans actually have been helped by the media in this regard. The perception that crime is going up, mm-hmm, a lot of that is driven by local TV news coverage. And as you know, on local TV news, often if it bleeds, it leads.
Right.
Because people are very interested in crime coverage. So if you watch your local news all the time and you're fed a steady diet of car break-ins, of murders and knifings and all of this stuff, then you're going to think that crime is up when it actually isn't.
The other thing that I asked Bob Stefanowski, we're talking to Terry Cowgill, contributing op-ed writer at Connecticut News Junkie, also blogs at Politicon. I didn't really give you a proper introduction because I'm so excited to talk to you, Terry. Now I forgot what I was just about to say. How about that? That never happens. Yeah.
I'm 65. It happens to me all the time.
All right. No, I know what I was going to get into. Obviously, you know, and the reason why I wanted you to critique, obviously, this interview for people who don't know, the last time you were on, you and I talked about the debate between Hayes and Logan. And the Hayes campaign took something that you said about George Logan and they tweeted it. And you took some flack on Twitter for it. I immediately messaged the Hayes campaign, and I was like, well, you guys are obviously listening. If you're going to use my stuff on Twitter, I expect that she's going to come here and talk to me now. And so yes, thank you. That actually was what got that thing done. But I wanted you to talk a little bit about sort of the pushback you got a little bit from people. All you did was make an observation about George. I don't think you said anything mean or nasty. You just made it, you know, a political observation.
Yeah, I mean, I just, you know, he was given two chances to state his position on the Mixmaster, and he didn't do it. In the first debate with Dennis House, he was asked about the Mixmaster. And Dennis actually showed some clips of it. So George knew that it had something to do with roads and bridges, but I don't think he was quite sure what it was. And he spoke in generalities about infrastructure. And then Hayes pointed out in her rebuttal, she didn't acknowledge the Mixmaster either, but she said, you voted against the bill that would have increased infrastructure funding. She felt the need to rebut that. So some people on Twitter said, well, Hayes didn't mention the Mixmaster either. And I'm like, well, it's pretty obvious that she knows what the Mixmaster is, so I don't really think that's an issue.
Yeah, and
as she said on your show, yeah. she drives over it like practically every day.
I had to ask her. That was literally, for anybody who didn't catch the interview, I said, Congresswoman Hayes, one last question. Do you know where the Mixmaster is? And as Terry said, yes, she said she drives over it every single day. My guest is Terry Cowgill, a contributing op-ed columnist at Connecticut News Junkie. He also blogs at Politicon. He's a retired managing editor of the Berkshire Edge in Great Barrington, Mass. If you don't regularly read Terry's articles, you're missing out. I think this is maybe the best op-ed guy in Connecticut. I love your work, and I always love talking to you, Terry, because I think you're just a really insightful guy, and I just wanted to let you know how much I appreciate your time and your great articles.
Well, thank you very much. And, you know, before I came on WICC, I never knew anything about it. I had been on WTIC with John Rowland several times.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know anything about WICC, and I'm glad I do now because it's a great talk radio station.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. I'll have to pass that along to the rest of the gang here. All right. So, Terry, any criticisms about her performance Monday in my interview with Johanna Hayes? Is there anything you didn't like her answer to, or that you thought she was evasive on?
Nothing I can think of off the top of my head. She was careful in what she said, like politicians always are. Politicians who are not careful find themselves getting into trouble all the time. And I don't think she was entirely candid and forthcoming on everything. But I thought that her answers were on point. And I think it's great that she had this opportunity to sort of rebut some of these some of the information that's out there that's not accurate. And she actually got to tell, you know, the thing that's the most interesting, I thought, was all this the accusation that she is for defunding the police.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the one that I found the most amusing because her husband's a cop for 27 years,
yeah.
I believe he was for the last 20 years or so, have been a detective in the Waterbury Police Department. And the idea that she would be for defunding the police is just so preposterous. Now, on the other hand, I don't know if she's taken a position on the police accountability law in Connecticut. It's obviously it's a state law, and so she wouldn't have anything to do with that. But I would like to find out whether she actually what her position was on that, whether she thought that was a good bill or not.
You know what? Next time I chat her up, that's going to be my first question. All right, Terry, the governor's race, the other day, Bob Stefanowski's campaign released to members of the media. I don't know if you got a chance to see it, but the internal polling, which shows them within 5 points. And his ads have been very aggressive. He was very aggressive on the debate Tuesday night. I feel like this guy's starting to pick up some momentum. I wasn't a big fan of his. Tuesday, I was talking to Jillian Gilchrist, the state rep from West Hartford, and I had already had her booked before his slip-up last week. Jillian had jumped all over it. Her quotes were in all the different articles. She and I started talking about it. And mid-interview, I got an email from the campaign, like, hey, Bob would love to come on. And I was like, yeah, of course. I have to say, I was kind of charmed by that guy a little bit. And the other thing was, we talked for about 30 minutes. I pushed back on two things he said. And I, you know, again, sort of, I was like, I don't want to hear the rhetoric. Give me a real answer. And he did. And a lot of the things that he said kind of hit home for me. And I'm like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to vote for that guy. But I think before we talked, I was a no. And now I'm like, oh, maybe. But it seems like he's starting to pick up some steam here.
I would be interested to see what the polling group is that conducted this particular poll. But often internal polls show it closer than external polls, number one. But number two, I do agree that he has picked up some momentum. I never thought that Lamont was going to win by 15 or 17 points. You know, you saw the Quinnipiac polls early on showing Lamont with a huge lead. I never thought he was going to win by that much. I think that Stefanowski is probably benefiting from some of the tailwinds that many Republican congressional candidates are experiencing right now, which is, inflation is unacceptably high. It's very, very difficult for people to make ends meet. And on the national level, Democrats are trying to run mostly on abortion rights and the threat to democracy. And when they don't address the issue of inflation, it makes them look like they're out of touch and like they don't really care about working people. Mm-hmm. And I think Stefanowski is benefiting from some of that perception here as well. He's willing to talk about it, whereas Lamont and the Lamont administration and most of the other Democratic candidates would rather not talk about it because it's an unpleasant thing for them to talk about.
Right. Terry Calgill is a contributing op-ed columnist at Connecticut News Junkie. He also blogs at Politicon, the retired managing editor of the Berkshire Edge in Great Barrington, Mass. Terry, it's funny. Both the Stefanowski and the Levy campaigns completely dismissed all the polls that came out that showed them down by double digits. Most Republicans I talked to were like, these polls are all nonsense. Nowadays, Republicans won't answer pollsters honestly, so there's no way of knowing. The second we saw the first polling from the 5th District that had Logan up a point over Hayes, suddenly those polls were the gold standard. All of a sudden, everything about that poll is dead accurate. And it's like, wait a minute. It's the same poll guys thought was nonsense a week ago. What's that all about?
it's that old problem that people who are consumers of media and polls have, and it's called confirmation bias. And if you see a result or you see a story in the media that is to your liking and it confirms something that you already believe, you're much less critical of it. And that's certainly the case with Republicans looking at these polls. No question about that.
By the way, on what you were just saying about in the governor's race, I've been predicting pretty much from the get-go that Lamont wins by roughly the same 3 points he won by in 2018. I don't think, you know, just looking at the polls, it's like we're living in on different planets. Republicans think that Connecticut's in the toilet, and the only thing that's going to save us is to get rid of Lamont. If you look at the polls, most Democrats are like, nah, Ned's doing great. And they're very supportive of him. And so it is going to come down to the unaffiliated voters who, based on the last polling I saw, were kind of in the middle on all that.
Yeah, well, that's where they are most of the time. That's why they're unaffiliated, right? Yeah, and I would say also, as you noted earlier about polls, is that certainly in the case when Trump was running, especially in 2016, there were a lot of people who either were ashamed to admit that they were voting for Donald Trump to a pollster, so they simply lied and said they were going to vote for Hillary, or maybe they would just hang up the phone and not take the poll, not participate in the poll at all, in which case Trump voters were being underrepresented in the poll. That could be the case here, although certainly Bob Stefanowski is not Donald Trump. That's an important thing to note. But nonetheless, if you're calling up, somebody is calling, Quinnipiac is calling up, and they want to talk to you and ask you what your preferences are, and you're a Trump voter, would you tend to be skeptical about Quinnipiac or some other polling outlet? Maybe. Yeah, it's certainly possible.
Terry, last thing I want to ask you before I let you go here. Obviously, this election, you know, you hear all the rhetoric about the most important election of our lifetime. Just the other day, Laura Devlin was here, and she was like, we can't afford four more years of the Democrats. And I said, with all due respect, it's been 40 years they've been running the show here. I don't think Connecticut's going to end up a dumpster fire if we did four more years. Just like I don't, if Bob wins, I don't think Bob's taking us back to the 1850s. That's a lot of this is political rhetoric. I was saying earlier, November 9th in Washington, D.C., going to be business as usual no matter who's in charge, just with a slightly different agenda.
I think so. And if we go back to when John Rowland was governor, you know, things didn't fall apart. There was some corruption, obviously. But, you know, most of the people who, you know, John Rowland surprised everybody by doing a lot for Connecticut cities. He really did. He funded a lot of money into them and initiated a lot of development projects, especially his hometown of Waterbury. So I think I tend to agree with you. I think some of these fears that Bob Stefanowski is going to take us back to the Stone Age are just ridiculous. But yep. Nonetheless, it's there.
Terry Cowgill, contributing op-ed columnist, Connecticut News Junkie, and at Politicon. Make sure you give this guy a follow on Twitter, at Terry Cowgill. Terry, always appreciate your time. I'll be in touch soon, my friend.
Okay, Joe. Thank you very much. Take care.
You too. My next guest is Christine Stewart. She is the editor of Connecticut News Junkie, has been since early 2006, after nearly 4 years as a reporter at the Journal Inquirer in Manchester. Christine, thank you so much. I know you don't have a ton of time, so thank you for making some for us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Big fan of yours. Big fan of Connecticut News Junkie. Before we get going here, I just want to tell you, great staff of writers on the team there. And doing this job with all your amazing op-ed writers has been so helpful. We've had a whole bunch of them on here. So, again, thank you for the amazing job that you guys are doing.
Well, thank you.
All right, I'm going to get the niceties out of the way. I'm just kidding here. Christine, right, the media gets, we get a lot
they
of.
Hit me.
I feel like the media gets a lot of flack for reporting the news, right? It's kind of a don't kill the messenger thing. What do you think of the media's role in society today?
Yeah, it is. I mean, and I think that it's gotten tougher. And I think that I see this on social media a lot. And I don't know. And it's been over the past, I want to say, maybe year, maybe 6 months, that people don't understand the difference between news reporting and opinion pieces and editorial.
Mm-hmm.
So somewhere the line got blurred, and it was probably blurred by, you know, television news and the 24-hour media cycle, because there just isn't enough of the, you know, objective, straight up news to get through a 24-hour news cycle, so they fill it in with commentary and with opinion. And somewhere along the line, the two of those got blurred together in people's minds, and there doesn't seem to be an understanding of the difference between the two. And, you know, there's not enough media literacy to begin with. And, you know, one of my columnists, Barth Keck, is a teacher, and, you know, he talks a lot about this in media literacy, and we really need to be starting them super early at understanding, you know, what an objective source is, what an authoritative source is, you know, the difference between a news story and an opinion story.
We actually had Barth on a couple weeks ago, and he was fantastic. And I think I had actually suggested that he teach a class for the adults because, Christine, my mom says to me all the time, my mom's over 70. That's all I'll say. She doesn't want me to pinpoint what her age is. But she tells me she struggles when she's reading a news article, whether it's fake news or not. And I typically say, Mom, if you read it and you're like getting freaked out and you're angry about what you're reading, that's probably fake news. Do you have any suggestions for how people can tell if what they're reading is legit or if it's just some big time spin or just a straight up lie?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you want to look at, you know, the number of sources in the story. So count how many people this reporter talked to for the story, whether they use the great thing about reporting online, which I always tell people, I'm so glad that I made the switch from print reporting to online reporting, is that primary source documents. So you have a document, you know, from the government, you know, maybe it's from the state budget office or from the auditors of public accounts. You can actually link that primary source document. So if somebody is reading this article and, you know, they don't necessarily trust what is written in the article or trust, they can go and they can link and they can actually read the document that you used in order to put that together, and they can form their own opinion based on that if they want to. So that's really great about that. I mean, you know, how many sources of authority did this person use, you know, versus, you know, just kind of like a man on the street type of interview, which doesn't happen as much in print reporting as it does something in like TV news reporting. But, you know, I see it too. I see, you know, with my parents are older, you know, my friends have parents who are older, and there's, you know, an MSNBC group and there's a Fox News group, and, you know, both are very diehard in one direction or the other, and they just watch the news channel all day, and they just get angrier and angrier, and on both sides. It mm-hmm. doesn't matter what side of the political spectrum they're on. Just continually to watch television news is draining and taxing, and it makes people angry.
Well, so you know,
turn off the TV.
Christine, I say to my mom all the time, I'm like, you know, listen, I don't mean to just pick on Tucker Carlson, because Rachel Maddow's doing the same thing on her station.
Exact same thing, and making that audience as mad as the other audience.
But
And
the difference is, you said, though, those are opinion shows. Like at 7 o'clock until the morning shows, it's all opinion shows. And if you're sitting there and you're watching a few hours of that, right, you're going to get all sorts of fired up by the stuff that you're
right.
seeing there.
And you know, and that's their goal. And, you know, and let's think about this, like, you know, it boils down to the bottom line for these guys. I mean, there's no such thing, no news program anymore, no corporate news entity cares about news. What they care about is that you're just a platform for advertising.
We're talking to Christine Stewart, We're talking to Christine Stewart, the editor of Connecticut News Junkie. Again, you know, to be doing on-air work in Connecticut and to be able to find great local reporting is increasingly more difficult. And not to make this about me, because it's really about just Connecticut in general. There are, we're seeing more and more sort of independent news sources out there. Do you think that's good or bad? And does
no,
that mean
th-
that the
are.
Big guys are letting us down?
I think that it does mean that the big guys are letting us down. And, like, let's not kid ourselves. The big guys are still the ones with the more eyeballs. Mm-hmm. But the fact that people in the state of Connecticut, we are really lucky and we are really blessed that there are all these independent local locally owned sources of news out there. And we can't lose sight of that. And we need to support that because, you know, these things can go away in an instant and you'll be left with the MSNBC and the, you know, the Fox News, and you'll just be angry all the time.
Yeah, right. And we're desperately trying to avoid that. I think you're having your lunch break now, which I'm sure you're not eating. So thank you again for giving us the time. Last thing, maybe you'll be able to squeeze something in before you get back to work. Are there any particular fact-checking sources that you use or that you would recommend over some of the other ones, especially, again, for a slightly older audience?
You know, a slightly older audience, you know, if you're going to read your news online and consume it online, you know, look for those links, look for the primary source documents, look to know, you know, trust and get to know your reporter and know that they're out there and they're trying to, you know, provide you information, and they're not trying to spin it one way or another. Really, most of us in the news industry are not opinion or commentary. We're just looking to provide you information so that you can get through your life.
It's funny you say that because, you know, this is a right-leaning radio station, and I'm more center-left than right. And sometimes I might be just reading from a poll, just reading poll numbers, and people will call up and they get super angry. And I'm like, I'm not giving you my opinion here. I'm reading you the results of a poll that was taken, right? Take it with a grain of salt here.
Well, I think things like that, polls changed in 2016 because, you know, not enough conservative voices were actually asked for their opinion. And, you know, the pollsters did get it wrong. And I think that also goes to communication method, too. I mean, you got to look at whether a poll did cell phone calls or whether they only did landline, or did they do text messages? Did they poll by text message? So are they getting the younger generation of voter out there? So, I mean, you know, a poll is a poll, but at the same time, you know, those are also things that we should let our readers know that we look at before we report the poll to make sure that the poll was done appropriately.
Christine, I appreciate your time. Again, you're like on a quick lunch break here, so thank you for giving us 10 minutes of maybe your 15-minute break. I hope you get to enjoy the last five. Big fan of both you and Connecticut News Junkie. Please keep up the amazing work that you guys are doing.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. That's Christine Stewart, the editor of Connecticut News Junkie.